lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night we'll bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast, and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone.
Mark Rogers is with us. He's the author of Accelerate the Sale, Kickstart Your Personal Selling Style to Close More Sales. Again, the book is Accelerate the Sales, Kickstart Your Personal... I can say that. You want to buy one? Kickstart Your Personal Selling Style. How was that, Mark? Hey, you wouldn't want one of these, would you? How's that for a close? Hey, Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
One of these days, and I swear I'm going to do it, I'm going to write a book, and the book is going to be called Once You've Blown the Intro, the Rest of the Show's Got to Be Good.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, we do talk about getting off to a fast start, and I am happy to say that our book is off to a fast start, too. We have just found out, Michael, that we are number 12 on the Inc. Magazine bestseller list already.
Wow. Hey, by the way, let me talk about one thing very quickly. Longtime Harley Davidson industry insider. Do you ride?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I was just riding yesterday. I've got a 2007 V-Rod VRSC DX. It's a night rod special.
Now, I had a little 150cc Honda, and somebody got into an accident with it and destroyed it, so I thought I wanted a bike. Now, this is going back to 1973, all right?
Yeah.
So in 1973, I decided to buy something. And I went out and I was taking a look, and my ex-wife at the time, I said, I'm coming home. I found it, and it was a chopper. It was 12 foot long, extended front end, and the frame was molded square. So, you know, it was handleable. Big 1200cc, and it was the best thing that I ever bought.
Yeah, right.
Hilda to the hog.
Let me ask you something. Do you still have that 1973 chopper?
Oh, no, it was gone 100 years ago, but I drove it for a long time because there was a bunch of us around town. I was in Southern California at the time. Everybody was, you know, I was in the insurance business at the time, and there was attorneys and there were doctors, and at night we put our leathers on and we rode.
Yeah, right on. Well, you know, it's funny that you say that because I could have sworn where this story was going to go. I thought you were going to tell me that your wife wouldn't let you have it, and that's why she's your ex-wife.
Close.
Well, you know, Michael, in the business, we call that spousal resistance when the wife doesn't want you to own a motorcycle.
No, and by the way, very interesting. You know what I've found over the years, and I think, Mark, this is phenomenally interesting. They say women don't have power. Every time you get to the point of sale with somebody and they're just about ready to say yes, what do they say? Let me ask my wife.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, and they say women don't have power.
One of the things that you have to do is you have to paint them into the picture. You have to bring everybody into the picture when you're selling.
Yeah, let them see themselves on the back of the Harley. This is good. Bugs in their teeth.
Or I have to tell you, fastest growing segment of riders right now are female riders, and they're moving from the back to the front, riding their own motorcycles. As a matter of fact, one of the most popular motorcycles for women these days is not, you know, one of the smaller Sportsters, as you might assume, but rather the Harley-Davidson Fat Boy. It's got a lower seat height, and a lot of women are riding them these days.
Yeah, no, I've noticed that, and I think in the last 10 years it started to become popular, and quote unquote, someone must have sold women the concept. Let me ask you this. I'm an old marketer. I've been around for, you know, 200-300 years now, maybe. Is there an overarching theme, Mark? Is there that constant, if you were to sell something to somebody in the 1950s and you were to do it today, is there a constant that's steadfast and will always be there?
Yes, and it's improving the buyer's condition. When in fact someone's world can be made brighter as a result of engaging your services or participating in your product or interacting with you as a sales professional, that is the overarching theme.
And one of the things that I've seen, especially today, you know, we've got a completely different kind of consumer today. You hit a button, and I'm in the Milwaukee area also. I'm in Mequon, as a matter of fact. If you hit a button today, there is something called beepbeep.com. Beepbeep.com will take you to every car dealership in the county and then beyond. You can zero in on to what you'd like. You can get a history. You can get a price. You can negotiate. And you don't even have to go down there. And most of them are working that way. So the salesperson today is up against a very interesting way of doing business, because the consumer is getting used to a certain way. And salesmanship, and by the way, salesmanship is one of the most important things that we have, because in any one way, shape, or form, somebody has sold somebody something. You fall in love and you say to her, "Will you marry me?" Offer acceptance. Now she's going to say yes or she's going to say no. If she says yes, she's accepted, she's been sold.
Right.
And so when we
You're absolutely right. Selling today is different than it ever was. You know, if you look at the evolution of selling, Michael, you know, in the 1950s, there was the go out and do the demonstration. This was the Fuller Brush Man, or the door-to-door vacuum cleaner salesperson, or the Tin Men that we'd know. And then it kind of evolved into scripts, where people were using predetermined scripts in order to sell things. This is where all the training was, you know, the 55 ways to close a deal. And then something strange happened, you know, in the 90s, where it came all about relationship selling. And it was really, you know, we like to call it take them to lunch selling, where we thought that if you bought someone lunch enough, or if you played golf enough with them, then that's how you would get the sale. And now it really has evolved into the people who are successful into a consultative area where, because there is such overwhelming information readily available at the consumer's fingertips, as you have just mentioned, the differentiating factor is the sales professional. And as I mentioned, if that sales professional can in some way educate, entertain, inform, make the buyer's world somehow brighter as a result of interacting with them, that's how you win the business today.
And by the way, there's a language to speak today, and I found it in all the years that I've been on radio, that there's a very interesting language. There's actually a biology behind the use of your words. Every word that you speak creates a mental picture in someone's mind. And you can say a word just because your definition of the word is one thing, their definition might be another thing. It's like this. If I say to you, if I say the word automobile, and I ask you to imagine an automobile in your mind, what kind of an automobile do you see?
Right. Well, I see a 1968 Camaro.
Okay. Now with me, and you got to promise not to tell anybody this. This is our secret here. That when this pops up for me, it's the very first car that I ever owned. It's been going on for 2 months now, and I've used the example, and which was a 1950 Studebaker. You know, it was blue. Had a blue. But I was 2 years old. I was tall at the time. But yeah, see, right. Here's the key. The message here is very important. With one word, you and I saw two distinctly different images. And in presentation, to make sure that when you say a word, is make sure that everybody sees the same image. I think one of the biggest mistakes that salespeople make today in any area of sales is that they think the way they think, and they won't step outside themselves to think the way the customer thinks.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, one of the skills that we encourage sales professionals to practice is using language, the efficacious use of language in closing business. I tell folks that they should practice describing common business situations on three different levels. One level, plain spoken. Another might be descriptive. Another might be sophisticated. So, you know, you could say things like, your past clients were happy. They were delighted. They were elated. The business conditions were tough. They were formidable. They were onerous. Your results were important or considerable, substantial or great, extraordinary, astonishing. And by doing that, what you do is you build your language skills and your language muscles, if you will, so that whenever you're in a situation, you you are able to adapt to that situation that you're in. You know, the whole concept of sales acceleration for us lies at the intersection of three dominant skill sets. And one of those skill sets is language skills. You know, being able to communicate in a compelling yet conversational manner is key. The other is offering expertise. But, you know, you must know something of what it is you're talking about, having unmatched understanding of what it is you're bringing to the table. And then the other, Michael, is really process proficiency. You know, you have to know what the next yes is in your sales sequence and how to get there. See, it's not about one big get, not one big yes. It's actually about a series of small agreements. And when you put those three things together, offering expertise, language skills, and process proficiency, well, that's how you close more business faster.
Yeah, Mark, when you do that, you also change brain chemistry. And realistically, what you just said early on when you said, you know, it's the certain ways of saying things will create a bond and a relationship, well, I'm paraphrasing, with that potential customer. But what actually happens when you say those things, they create those mental images. And I think the entire key in any kind of a transference of back and forth communication, you know, you send, somebody else receives, there's got to be the recognition of familiarity of something that you're missing, or what you don't know that you're missing. And I think it's in that recognition and that picture that goes on in that person's mind, and everything you're saying is building to that, triggers a physiological effect inside them, and it actually stimulates chemicals. And you hit the right chemical, you've made the sale.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny that you talk about chemicals and the neurological changes that happen with language. In the book, we talk about how sales can be positively addicting. And we talk about the research about how, you know, when you make a sale, it's stimulating and it's thrilling. And you get the dopamine and the norepinephrine, and all of those things start to click in. And it's a virtuous and perpetuating self-reinforcing cycle. Pardon the pun.
And you're addicted. Yeah, no, absolutely. No, it's absolutely addicting. And you just said it. The dopamine, that little squirt of the dopamine coming from the feel-good center of your brain, that in effect will close a sale. And I think that beyond all sales, beyond it, beyond the feature in and of itself, that perceived value for the individual out there, they've got to be able to experience a sense of the potential of emotional satisfaction for making the decision to make the purchase. I think that in and of itself is the end goal, because no matter what we say, if they don't have that, if that's not triggered within them, then one of two things happens. Somebody walks into your store and they're interested in what you have to offer. They were there because they came in, they were interested. One of two things happened. They either buy or you talk them out of it.
Right.
Yeah.
I love language, and it's just so interesting. Let me make a note here. Have you ever heard of subversive prestige?
Say it one more time.
Subversive prestige.
No.
The linguists refer to this. You know how sometimes there will be kind of middle-class kids hanging out at the mall, and they're talking as if they are the hardcore gang-banginest kids around?
Yeah.
Well, the reason that they do that is they adopt the language of the street toughs because they feel as if it elevates them somehow. You know, it gives them subversive prestige. Well, one of the things we talk about in the book is we talk about how to create insider's prestige. And what you need to do, whatever industry you're working in, whatever company you're working with, they have a particular language. And what you need to do is discover that language and then use it effectively. And that does many of the things that you're talking about, Michael.
You know where I thought you were going to go with that? Subversive prestige. You walk in and you say, if you don't buy from me, we're coming to get you.
Well, there's always that method.
There was always that, yeah. No, I think it's wonderful. And let me tell you why what you're doing right now, the accelerate the sale, the kickstart your personal selling style. In today's world, Mark, especially in today's world, with all of the people that are out of jobs, they have to go home, work on their computer. They become quote-unquote entrepreneurs. So they get a great idea. Well, the idea is not any good unless you can put it into the hands of the people or your target market or your potential market. And so today, more than ever, people have to learn the art, and it is an art of salesmanship.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And I'm thrilled to hear that you're saying that you're excited about our movement. You know, one of the other things, Michael, that we're really trying to do is create communities. And we're trying to get professionals to work together to get better. So, you know, of course, we've got the Accelerate the Sale on LinkedIn and, of course, Accelerate the Sale on Facebook. But one of the other cool initiatives that we're just about to launch August 1st is we are launching a Your Greatest Sale Ever contest, where we are scouring the planet and asking for sales professionals to share their moments of success so that we can share them with others. And of course, you know, to do this, we are speaking to salespeople. You know, the grand prize is $1,000, and then for three runners-up, they get $500 apiece. And we want to find the greatest sales ever stories on the planet. And we're going to share them and communicate that with them. And that's how people grow and get better, and by sharing others' experiences.
Oh, no question about it. And I really believe that camaraderie, a collaborativeness, has really got to do, that's one of the elements of success today. You can't do it alone. You know, that old 6 degrees of separation. You know, if you had something and you told somebody who told somebody who told somebody, maybe you could get to 50, 60, 80 people. Today, if you have the right message, you can get to hundreds of millions of people. So the world is open to you. All you have to do is know how to create the key to put in the door to get it open.
Yeah. Incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I think it's great. And you know what? The people that are starting to make it now, the people who have lost their jobs, the people who have lost their businesses and are starting over, are the very thing that created this country in the first place. It's, you can go out and have anything you want to do if you're willing to go out and do it.
Well, and I have to tell you that it really is encouraging, and we are living in, yes, the business climate and the employment climate right now is challenging, and at the same time, we have never lived in a time with which information was so free, so readily accessible, and your ability to improve and acquire the skills to be successful have never been more available. You know, often in business, I think salespeople and everyone, you know, sometimes they suffer a crisis of confidence. And I will tell you that confidence is built, in my opinion, on two foundations. One is skill acquisition. You have to have the skills to do what it is you're trying to do. If you don't feel comfortable in the presence of executives, well, you know, there are things that you need to do. Perhaps it is you're not comfortable making small talk. Perhaps you're not comfortable with table etiquette. Perhaps you're not comfortable in the language of the C-suite, which is primarily, you know, the income statement or the balance sheet. Well, guess what? We have just identified here three very specific skill sets that you or I, with a quick Google search, could get the information and put it into play. The other thing I believe that enhances confidence is having high-quality options.
Sure.
And that's
no
why
question.
It's imperative to not see every opportunity as the single opportunity that's going to make you or break you. You know, I've been told that the Tyrannosaurus Rex to the modern-day cheetah, these superb, supreme predators of Mother Nature, we're only successful about 10% of the time, right?
So, again, you know, Mark, I hate to do this to you, but we're running out of time. But how's this for closing? Two things. One is, I want one. How is that for effect?
Yeah, great.
I want one. Okay, and the other thing is the website we can find you at.
Okay, you can find us at acceleratethesale.com.
Okay, Mark Rogers, thank you so much for joining us, and I promise we'll have you come back again and wait till you hear your next intro.
Great, Michael. Thank you.
Okay, take care, Mark. Good night.
Bye.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Paris.
Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. By the way, if there's an issue that you want... Oh, I love that music. No, I don't. If there's an issue, if there's something you want to hear discussed, get a hold of Radio Susie. Go to www.dresserafterdark.com, and she's right there. And if there's a guest that you would love to hear, go ahead and go to the website if there's any comments that you want to make about anything that we're doing, the guests, etc., so on and so forth. Because the one thing the show is about... You can have tremendous amount of subject matter on the show, but in the end result, if you core it right down to its simplest, the show's about you. Money and smart. Ted Hunter is with us. Ted Hunter has co-founded a real estate brokerage company that grew to a staff of more than 100 agents. He's become a multimillionaire and then went bankrupt in the real estate crash of the 1980s. And from his experience, he came to understand the cycles of both the real estate market and financial markets in general. And let us say, Ted, hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you, Michael. I'm really glad to be here. I feel like there's a little kindred spirit here. I looked your bio, and you went from L.A. to Alaska to Milwaukee, and I went from New York to Maui to North Carolina. It's like, similar things in your business background and mine. I thought, oh, this will be fun.
Oh, sure. Oh, and by the way, absolutely. You know, I'm looking at this, and one of the most important things that I saw in this is about learning what money means, if we go down to the core of it, and not even so much handling it, is what is it? And I think if most people had a concept of what it is that you have to offer, they would look at the world differently.
I certainly agree with that, I knew a lot about money, but I had to do a lot of research because I wanted to make sure that I was covering everything, how to buy a house, how to buy a car, how to use legal services and pick insurance, you name it. And so I had got experts to watch my back, you know, and make sure they filled in the gap. So it took 3 years. But during those 3 years, Michael, you touched a nerve there. You come away with such a perspective on what money's perspective is. You know, if we were to say health, happiness, and wealth, we took those three issues. I came away with such an impact on their relationship and on the need to see to it that money is positive and not negative to people's health and happiness and relationships and life. It's the strangest thing. It's the nicest thing in the world, and it's become the biggest 600-pound gorilla in the room for trouble. And
oh,
so,
no
yeah,
question.
You touch a nerve there.
Yeah, Ted, when you really look at it and money and whatever it represents, you know, you're 15 years old, you have a definition of money. You're 25 years old, you have another definition of money. Then you're 35, 40, and on up, you have a completely different definition. If you, Ted Hunter, today were to make financial decisions based on what you thought money was when you were 15 years old, you would be in a lot of trouble. So money,
yep,
based on culture is going to transition in definition, and it's important to understand that. And the other thing that I think of, they talk about wealth, happiness, and whatever. That's not money. I think what money in the end result is what is the wealth? What's the happiness? What is that going to do for you? How's it going to make you feel? And it comes down to something called emotional satisfaction. If based on my financial decision-making, I can feel good about what it is, then all of a sudden I'm going to take the step. That's the call to action. Let me give you a prime example, and then we'll get the issue because I think this is critical. If I could give you a check for $150 million right now, today, Ted Hunter, and there was no obligation, it's yours, are you going to get some satisfaction out of it?
Oh, I'll get a lot out of it.
Yeah, okay.
Because I'm going to give it all away.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter.
I would love that challenge.
Absolutely. Now, try it this
way. That's my honest reaction.
Okay, no, try it this way. if you were going to get the $150 million and you knew if you got it next Friday, you'd have to die, all of a sudden it takes the impetus out of it, and it has no meaning at all.
You're touching on that, the thing that, again, echoed in my mind for 3 years, that the more I understood things, is this famous and unavoidable truth. Nobody on your deathbed ever wishes for more money or more objects.
Yeah.
They wish they'd done things different. They wish they'd done things they didn't do. They wish they'd treated people different. They wish they'd spent more time with people. Nobody wishes for more money.
No, no. And there's a saying that ties right into this. Life can only be understood backwards, but you have to live it today.
Yeah, but I don't want to underestimate the importance of money to the people listening, because for most people right now, money, like it or not, has become a very critical element. We have a humongous problem going on right now, Michael. You know that, and we've got to. What I'd love to get across to everybody, and the reason I took this project, is that there's so much you can do to change the game in your favor. And the first thing you've got to do is you absolutely abandon the existing system of personal management in this country. You've got to. I mean, and I've got the proof on that. That's beyond any discussion. And I think that as much as you and I agree that money on your deathbed is not your priority, there's a lot of people now with serious issues. We've got 61% of the people living check to check. And we've got 10 million baby boomers that got caught in the problems that have occurred that I can describe. I know why they happened. And they can't retire. And we could talk about being on your deathbed, but if you're 63 years old and you've worked hard all your life and you're looking ahead and you can't retire, that is not a good situation.
No,
has become more important than it should be in a way.
No, it's the symbol of money, I think, is what it is. And I think that the title of your book, Money Smart, that's really what it's about. Understand what it is that you're dealing with. I love money. Money's wonderful. It doesn't mean that it doesn't mean if you have a lot of money that it's going to be at somebody else's expense. That's not what it's about. But money in and of itself is a wonderful thing.
Yeah,
it's very hard to create today.
But when it puts tremendous pressures on you, which is what's happened to people, when it destroys health, when 11 million families have lost their homes and counting, 10 million people can't retire, we got to do something. And that's why I wrote the book. I mean, I sat by and watched this thing. I knew this system of money management was no good. I've known it for 20 years. But finally, when people started losing their homes, that was it. It was 2007, and I said, I've had it. No one will speak out and tell people what to do. I'm going to do my best to do that.
Good.
That's good.
I'm serious when I say that. Good. Because money and the way to handle money is a process. And if you don't understand the process, especially, and you said it, Ted, especially today, you're going to get in trouble.
You know, if I may, Michael, I would like to get across to people the true depth of the problem that they've been facing, because you and I both know the old adage that understanding the problem is 90% of the solution is true. It's true. And people don't know. Even the people that haven't been that hurt have gotten so much more less than they should have from working all these years. If you don't mind, Mike, I'd love to get across to them what the root of this problem really is.
Sure, go ahead. Your microphone. All right. Go for it.
Okay. What's happened is that we never learn anything in school, and we've been basically, our industries have constructed our system of money. And in so doing it, there are three myths that have just become devastating. And the first myth, that money management is so very complicated, and it's not. Not if it's explained properly, it's not. The second is that the experts are better than you, and I'm sorry to tell you, the experts are a lot worse than you. And I'm going to show you that in a second. And the third is that there's always this feeling it's always a good time to invest, it's always a good time to buy, it's always a good time to spend money. And that has been spun so successfully, and that's not true. You know, always invest for the long run is one of the biggest disasters I've ever seen for the American public. It's great for the financial services industry. And Michael, I want you to know that it's not me talking. I've dug into this. I've got on my site, for example, two studies so draconian, so powerful, that the industries had to bury them. I mean, one was led by the Harvard Business School with teams of people, and the other one is by the number one research company in the United States, the financial services. And the answers to these things are so brutal that people have to, that's the problem. So before we're through, Mike, and there's a lot to tell you, I want people to know about those two studies. I want them to know the truth, because then they can start taking care of themselves.
Yeah, the biggest problem, Ted, that we have today, and you started what you just said with this, but I'm going to add to it. People work on problems that they don't have instead of the problems that they do have, and
Amen.
You never get anywhere. So,
Amen.
And when you said it's not you that's talking, yes, it is. You become the doorway to the information. Do you hear it?
Yeah, I'm the doorway, but when I show them these sources and these people that have been silenced and buried, that have studied this and are telling the truth. Michael, you're right. People are not working on the right problem. And I think that's really, if nothing else today, I want them to know that. I want them to know what the problem really is. It's pretty amazing.
Oh, absolutely, it's amazing, and especially in today's world. There is so much rhetoric out there. There's so many mixed messages, and too many people, instead of worrying about what's going on with the economy, they're worried about somebody who they think might have killed her baby, quote unquote. You know, we get off to these things and we hide because we don't want to see what's going on. It's really time, Ted, that people stood up, took a look at what's going on, and started to fix it. And it gets fixed. I mean, I know this is going to sound old and cliche, but it gets fixed one person at a time. And that's really how you do it. Then it becomes collaborative.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Michael, let me see if I can get a question over what the real problem is. The real problem is that we have a financial services industry that serves themselves completely and is not competent at doing the things they talk about. Let me mention two studies that are just end of game. There's a study was led by a team from the Harvard Business School. That's hard to beat. And it was combined with four or five other major, highly professional teams. And they wanted to study whether financial advisors, to what degree they helped their clients. And the financial industry supported the study, provided the data, confident this would be a great flower in their cap to market off of. The study turned out to be disastrous for them, and they had to bury it because the answer, and it was called the study of the decade, trillions of dollars in all these teams, was as follows. That not only do investment advisors underperform the market, they underperform what people do on their own if they don't have an investment advisor. And worse yet, the average performance of somebody who did not have an investment advisor was over twice the investment return of the advisors. Yes, think about that before I give you part two, which is worse.
Sure.
I mean, they had to bury it. They were like, oh, my God. Now, I'll tell you, I walked in their doors, an outsider insider in 1990, and I knew in a matter of weeks that what that study showed was true. They were interested in asset acquisition. There was no interest in investment and no experience and no track record. Now, the second study. Dalbar Associates is regarded the number one research firm in the country financial services industry. Dalbar study from 1984 to 2004, the greatest moment in stock market history. The stock market went up 700%. If you put $10,000 in the stock market in 1984, you'd have $101,900 of profit after inflation. The majority of stock investors doing that marvelous golden one-time opportunity that put $10,000 in the stock market after inflation, they did not have $101,900. They had $2,700. All of the gains were gone.
Okay, but when we say the gains are gone, and we know the answer to this, where did the gains go? Whose pocket?
The gains went to two things. They went to paying for the billion. We know that the financial industry has billions in bonuses and all this money, and people make so much money. Number one, where'd your money go? You paid for them. And number two, you're looking at the depths of the incompetence, chasing one hot fund after another, trying to outsmart the market. The depth of incompetence was phenomenal. And what happened was an opportunity of unprecedented opportunities to the American public was bled away to special interests, to the financial service industry, and to a limited number of people, because the people believed that these experts were experts. And the number one step I'm telling everybody has to do today, especially when it comes to investing, is do it yourself. And it's simple.
No question about it, because if you go politically and you look at it over the years, administrations have come and gone, presidents have come and gone, Republican, Democrat, whatever the case may be.
Yep.
But the only thing that has stayed constant is is business. Business has stayed true to their original core, which is making money. And if you ever want to know where to find the problem, you know the old statement, Ted, it's follow the money. And if you follow the money, you know what the problem is.
Yeah, you and I are both business people. I'm not trying to paint them black, but the fact of the matter is they're going to try and make money. And unfortunately, I'll tell you something interesting. They think they know how to invest. I'd like a nickel for every person I met inside there that does the same investing for their clients that they do for other people. And they lose money right along with the rest of them. They don't have a clue. One example of stupidity, I mean, maybe a strong term. You want an example of just how bad it gets. Is the absolutely insane idea you should always invest for the long run. Tell that to the people that bought a house in 2005 and 2006, and all the experts are saying, oh, it's always good to invest for the long run. Tell that to the people that didn't sell their stocks, let alone kept buying stocks in 1999, 2000, 2001. I folded my stock business because it was 99. I told my clients, get out. This is crazy. These prices are nuts. Go to fixed income and real estate. And, of course, it's 11 years later, and you'd still be losing money. And so it's an industry that got so caught up in it that, to tell you the truth, Michael, they're not bad people. Even they invest their own money that way. It doesn't work. You want to invest your money, ladies and gentlemen? It's simple. Number one, when the time is right to invest, you do no load, no commission, broad-based index funds only. They will blow away all the funds, proven time and again. And the other thing is you don't invest in a badly overpriced market. And what I do on my site, it's there for free. I tell you when a market's become overpriced or dangerous. You just go there, Money Smart Online, and I'll tell you. Do it yourself. Don't invest in overpriced markets. And if you're doing the stock market, do an index fund, and you will beat the living daylights out of all the experts. And that's what those two studies are telling you. They're burying.
Ted, we're starting to run out of time. I want to have you come back on because I think this is an issue that people really have to address. And when it really comes down to it, we've allowed ourselves to get here. If we want to point a finger at anybody, you go to the mirror in the bathroom and you point at yourself because somebody had to allow it to happen. And with that, Ted, do you have your website?
Michael, you're so right. I just want to tell you, you're so right on that. You are. We're guiltier than anybody.
I hear it loud and clear. Website we can find you at?
MoneySmartOnline.com.
Okay, MoneySmartOnline.com. Hey, Ted, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time. I hope everybody buys that book. Okay, take care. Good night.
You too.
If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk. What is that song? Do I like it? No. Anyways, Nina Amir back with us. Your inspiration to creation coach inspires you to create the results that you desire. And working with writers, she inspires them to create publishable and published products and careers as writers and authors. And she's a seasoned journalist, a book editor, a blogger, writing, and an author coach. And let us say, Nina, welcome back.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be back.
How are you?
I'm good. You forgot to say that I have a book coming out.
Nina has a book coming out. See, this is good. Now we're really... Okay. Ah, and the name of the book? How to Blog a Book. I think that's... Actually, that's extremely important. That's another way that authors can actually get their word out, isn't it?
It is. It is. Yeah. Blogging is a great way to get the word out.
No, I think it's absolutely wonderful. And blogging in the last 4 or 5 years, it's exploded. There's so many places to put blogs, and there's some places that actually will pay you to have a blog on their site.
There are some places that will pay you to put a blog on their site. I wish I could find one, because I spend a lot of time blogging. But blogging is a lot of fun, and it's a great way for authors to build a platform, and they need a platform if they're going to publish a book.
It's true. Now, okay, I want to do this because I'm writing this down, and the name of the book is your new book.
How to Blog a Book.
It's How to Blog a Book.
How
when is it going to be
blog
done?
Blog a Book. And wait, I'll give you the subtitle even if you want it.
Ah, yeah.
A Step-by-Step Guide to Writing and Publishing Your Manuscript on the Internet, One Post at a Time.
Oh, is that good or what? Very interesting.
Yeah, whether the publisher keeps that name, I have no idea at this point. Book won't be out until June.
I thought it was going to be out
in March, but they have a mind of their own.
Yeah, don't they? Yeah. Okay, but when we talk the step-by-step, you know, is that creating each chapter into a module?
Well, you're writing posts, and what I recommend is you write your posts, which are short, 250 words or 500 words, and you're creating a manuscript as you go in Microsoft Word, and then you're putting them online at the same time. So you're creating a manuscript in one place and you're putting them online, and so you are creating the chapters also. So you should have an idea in advance of what your book looks like.
Oh, okay.
So yes,
now let me ask. I want to take you a step ahead on this. Because I was talking to somebody in the last couple of days who had, you know, there's this phenomenal idea that she has, and she says, I want to do a book proposal. And I said, what's that? And she couldn't give me an answer, but she knew she had to do one. So what are we dealing with a book proposal?
Okay, so yeah, no matter how you write your book, whether you blog a book or you write a book or you have a great idea and you want to be traditionally published, you're going to have to write a book proposal. And what a book proposal really is a business plan for your book. And that's really a kind of simplified way of saying it, but when you hand over, it's also a marketing document. So marketing document really is a business plan. So when you want a literary agent to represent you, or you want the acquisitions editor at a publishing house, which is the person who acquires books for the publishing house, to get an idea of what your book's about and say, yes, I want to represent you, whether it's the agent or you want them to say, yes, I want to buy your book, you have to give them something in their hands that they can get an idea of what you're writing about. But you can't just tell them what the idea is. They have to also know whether there's a market for the book. They have to know what other books are out there that compete with your book. They have to know what you plan to write. Whether it's, if for nonfiction, they want to know, what's going to be in the book in terms of chapters and content, but you don't have to actually write the whole book. They also want to know who you are, whether you're the right person to write the book, especially for nonfiction. Are you the expert on the topic? And do you have this author's platform, this built-in readership for the book? And how do you plan to help promote the book, as we talked about last week? You know, are you going to help do this? Are you going to be a good business partner? All of this goes into that book proposal. And for fiction writers, for novelists, or for even children's authors, they want to also have a synopsis of the book, and they still kind of want to know who you are, whether you're an expert, whether you're going to be a good enough writer, and they still want to know, are you going to help promote the book? So they want to have that promotion plan. So it's still a business plan for the book. And they do want to know still, do you have a platform? Who knows who you are when you put out this novel, who's going to run out and buy it? So all of that, and they all still want to know the markets and all those other things. So all of that goes into this book proposal. It's a huge document. I always joke, but it's really not a joke, that you could write this book, you could write your book faster than you could write the book proposal.
Yeah, no, by the way, when you really come down to it, and I've seen this time and again, and I've interviewed tons of authors over the years, and I've seen it time and again, and I've heard the story. Somebody has an idea, they're going to write a book. So somebody publishes the book for them, and it costs them an arm and a leg. Now they've got all these books that they had to order, and we know the publishing company's making a few bucks here, and they've got all these books, now they're sitting in the garage. What do I do now? Who's going to teach me how to get on the radio? Who's going to teach me how to blog? Who's going to teach me how to do a proposal? What do I do and how do I do it? And those are all of the things that most beginning authors don't think about. Why don't they think about it? Because nobody told them that the M word, marketing. Marketing is critical. And unless you have somebody holding your hand to bring you through it, you're going to get in trouble.
Right, and they really, it's just like you said, they don't think about it in advance, which is why when clients come to me, I typically tell them that they need to have done it long ago. I had somebody come to me just this week, and she had put together a proposal, but it's not right. I don't know where people go for their information. And, you know, she had a proposal, but it looks more like maybe she knows about business and not about publishing. You know, she didn't go out and buy the book on how to write a book proposal. And now she has a publisher in England who's interested in her book and wants it ASAP. Well, she contacted me actually first time last week. And I was already telling her, because she was going to some kind of pitch fest, you know, where you pitch your books. And she wanted a pitch for that, you know, just like a 25 or 50 word pitch. And I had said, you know, what about the proposal? Are you ready? If they say go. And she didn't really respond. Well, now suddenly we're having to revamp the whole proposal because it's not up to industry standards.
You know, when you really come down to it, there's so many people who walk into this business innocently. And they do it. They're innocent. And you ask the question, the rhetorical question, though, you know, where did they go to get the information? Well, where did she get her information? From someone who she thought knew what they were talking about, which ended up to be a very limited in scope of the issue in and of itself, and probably cost her an arm and leg.
Well, I have to give her some credit. She did go to a writer's conference, which is where she met me. She showed up sitting across from me at this book doctor thing that they had going on. They put a bunch of writing coaches and editors in a room, and you can go and you can talk to them for free. It's a volunteer thing we do, and I spend many hours across the desk for 5 minutes at a time talking to aspiring authors. And so she did get some initial information. But the question is, you know, if you go spend $600 or $800 on a writer's conference and you get all this information, what do you do with it? So she obviously didn't take it to the next level. She did write a proposal, but this particular conference is run by a man, a literary agent, who wrote the book on how to write a book proposal.
Oh, who is that?
So, Mike Larson.
Mike Larson.
He wrote a book called How to Write a Book Proposal.
Wrote a book.
Sold over 100,000 copies.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's good stuff. But the key is, I'm going to go back to what I said about her, and I don't know her, so it's okay to say something. But what she did, she ended up across from you. She ended up talking to you, but she had already gotten the proposal, right?
Well, I don't know how far she had gotten with her proposal at that point. But my point is just that she did go to the extent of going to a conference. So if you're asking where do people go to get information, she did go to a conference and get information.
Okay.
The question is, at that point, what do you do with the information you have? So there she is with people who know something about publishing, and I think at that point she could have gone the next step, which is to use that information correctly and use the industry standard to create a book proposal.
Well, sure.
Right?
What
not
was
to use the you know, business standard for a book proposal, because the business standard doesn't work in the publishing industry. You need the publishing industry standard.
Do you remember the movie with Robert Redford called The Candidate?
Yes.
Okay. Yep. He ran for office because they knew he wasn't going to win. And what they said to him was, you can just say anything you want to say. So he said, right on, and I'm on it. So he goes through all this stuff, and all of a sudden he starts gaining popularity, and he wins the election. He's the president of the United States. So after he learns he's won, they get him into the car. They're driving down the street with all the people who are promoting him and whatever. And he started laughing, and they said, what's the matter? He says, now what do I do?
Right.
Yeah. And so, I mean, really,
So that's the problem with most aspiring authors. They really don't know what to do once an agent calls or once a publisher says, I'm interested.
Yeah.
So they need to start at the beginning, which is what I call the proposal process. They don't actually have to write a proposal. Matter of fact, if you're going to self-publish, you don't have to write a proposal. But I suggest you go through all of the parts of a proposal. I mean, there are many parts of that make up a proposal, different sections, but go through them and compile that information so that you know, just like an acquisitions editor at a publishing house, that you know whether or not your idea holds water, because that's what they're going to do. Know whether your idea holds water and whether you have what it takes to be an author, because authors don't just write, not today.
They're good
business people, and they're good speakers, and they get on the radio, and they do all kinds of crazy things. I have a friend who sells a ton of books, and you know what? He does it not just by being a writer. He wrote a book. I think he was actually on your show, Michael. He wrote a book about the Jews of Sing Sing, and he gets out there dressed in prison garb, and he now sells jewelry that is they're little black sheep, like little black sheep earrings, because his book is about the black sheep and families, because he's a genealogist by trade.
Yeah.
And he also sells little black sheep stuffed animals dressed in, you know, black and white prison garb. He does everything under the sun.
Yeah. Do you remember in the
70s?
I know you're not old enough, but I know, do you remember the 70s with the pet rock craze?
Yeah, I remember. I'm old enough for that.
I know. I was being good over here.
Right.
That was a great compliment, too. All right, Nina, we're just about out of time. Website we can find you at?
You can find me at www.ninaamir.com or at Copyright Communications, spelled like shipwright, Copywright communications.com. And if somebody's really interested in a proposal, Michael Ray, at Copyright Communications, there is a product called Easy Schmeezy Book Proposal Template.
No, I love it. Don't ask me to spell that, but I think that's great.
They'll find it.
Hey, Dan,
because
we'll
it's not so
week.
Easy to write a book proposal. It really isn't. That's why I help so many people with them.
My standard, when they call me about my book, they'll say, you do this, now call Nina. All right. We'll talk to you next week.
All right. It was great, Michael Ray. Have a great week.
Good night.
Good night.
Because you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in wrong, yeah, you know it's going to grieve me. Yeah, I'm going to miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these days. Said some of these days I do it so free. You're going to miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're going to miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only. Cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if for you need me, you
now some of these days.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Greg writes with us. He's the author of Daddy Dates, Four Daughters, One Clueless Dad, and His Quest to Win Their Hearts. This is the roadmap for any dad to raise a strong and a very confident daughter. He's the founder and president of the Right Track Consulting Company, working with businesses nationwide as a motivational speaker, executive coach, business growth specialist. And before launching his consulting company, Greg was a youth minister for many years, working with families and teens at churches across Texas. And most importantly, the dynamic self-described music nut is the 40-year-old father of four teenage girls. And if Greg has any qualifications to write Daddy Dates, questionable at best, he says. Victoria, Haley, Whitney, and Madison are the highlights of his resume. And let us say, Greg, welcome to the show.
Thank you, sir. It's good to be here. I appreciate it.
Four daughters. That must be fun. Did they issue Prozac with them?
Fun's an interesting way to describe it. It's definitely fun. It creates challenges. There are multiple moments when I'm not quite sure exactly what planet I'm on, and sometimes I need a little direction and some help. But without question, it's the most rewarding challenge I've ever experienced in my life. That is for sure.
Oh, no, not absolutely. There's no question about it. And well, you know what? Are you hearing a reverb for some reason? Let me play with the equipment here. Okay. Well,
while you're at it, I'm hearing you, but I'm hearing you very quietly.
Ah, okay. That we can do one of two things here. Well, how about that? Did that work better?
That's a tad better, yes, sir.
Okay, let me try that again. And the magic angels that float around the equipment at the network will fix it. Okay, and if you can't hear me, yell at me. Okay, now, by the way, four daughters raising four daughters. What do you find is one of the major problems? Is there an overarching theme, not so much a problem, but just to be able to bond with them, because they've got, I see the picture of them on the book, they look like they've got four completely different personalities.
Indeed, they do. There are some similarities, but you're right, they're incredibly unique, as it tends to go. If I had to say that there was one sort of primary theme that I embattle the most, it would be probably communication. Effective communication in the sense that that there's not an awful lot of backpedaling and dialogue or, wait, what do you mean by that? I'm not so sure what that means. It requires a very concerted, focused effort on strategic listening and paying acute attention to what it is that they're trying to communicate to me in sometimes the most benign sort of ways. I mean, it could be just simple dialogue about their day or perhaps some strategy or some conflict, rather, that they're dealing with and a strategy and how to get there. And if I'm in my own world doing my own thing, I can't seem to get the translation to connect. So I have to pause, shut down my brain, turn and focus my attention on their heart and their head and really do my best job to connect. And even that sometimes is super bumpy and it doesn't always work great. But if I had to say that, if there was some sort of primary thing, I would have to point at that.
Now, by the way, with the age of the kids, Victoria 17, Haley 16, Whitney 14, and Madison 13, even with the just year or so difference between them, they live in completely different cultures, quote unquote. They were brought up with their friends, and we have such a rapidly changing society that it's got to be hard to find that cut it right down the middle way of talking to all of them. Each one has to be completely different, and also I would venture to guess, and I've never been in a situation like you're in, that you would have to move into a completely different mindset for each one of the girls.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, it's a different mindset, but it's also how they interpret their world. I mean, my oldest one is definitely more of a people pleaser. She pays really a lot of attention to making sure that she is doing the right things. My second daughter is wanting to be right and wanting to do the right things, but in addition to that, she views the planet quite differently than the first, and she seems to really deal most acutely with the way that she thinks and feels about things, and where one is super amenable, the other one is a little bit more challenging in the way that she anticipates anticipates your answer, you know, or how she might feel neglect in a certain way. And then the third is a lot more relationally savvy. She's super cool about a lot of things, very non-reactionary. And the fourth one is super high-strung with super creativity coursing through her veins and is sometimes difficult to understand when she's really, really, you know, charged up and talking, you know, very emphatically about a particular thing. So, I mean, that's just some light brushstrokes on their four personalities. But indeed, their differences create great challenges. And with great challenges come really smart solutions. And I think that's probably where Daddy Dates comes in, is how do I strategically connect to each one when they're all sort of sprawled out in different directions? How am I going to be able to parent these girls? Just as soon as I seem to get some kind of a solution with one, I try applying that to the next, and that seems to not necessarily fit. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. And the only way for me to personalize my parenting style seems to be directly towards connecting and tailor-making the way I do reach out to each one. And Daddy Dates has been the vehicle for me to do that.
Face, and it'll start probably with the older one in the next year or two, or maybe the older one now, maybe Victoria, and then they'll come in line with this, is there's the term that you use in your press release. The term is to raise a confident woman-to-be. They're all women-to-be. They're women in waiting, quote-unquote, to become. And they're not ready. They're not women yet. And the key is, how do you work with them when you know that they're not women yet? Maybe the 18-year-old, but you know they're not women yet. There's so much more they have to learn, but they don't know that they're not women yet. That's got to be a tough one.
It's tough, but I got to tell you, I think within the challenge of that, it's just connecting to them where they are. And where they are, you sort of parent in the moment. I'm doing my best to try to prepare them for their adult planet. But for the most part, if I'm parenting in the moment, I'm parenting her at the age which she's at, which she's newly turned 18, and I have to be in this space with her. So we have to deal with 18-year-old conflicts and an 18-year-old solution. That's challenging. But you know, as you well know, I mean, you parent where you are. And and as they're dealing with, you know, Daddy, where, you know, what about college? What about this college over this one? You just have to cohabitate in that moment, and that's where it lies, you know.
Oh, sure, and obviously, no question about it. And this is one of those things where, let's say, the book like yours, that if you have someone in a similar situation, nobody teaches you how to do this. So to have a quote-unquote a hand manual that says, take a look, here's some of the experiences, this is what's happened, this is the way it got handled, that most people do not have. And I think especially for men, somebody once said to me on the air years ago, and it had to do with why women were more emotional than men were. And it had to do with she said they have more lap time. And boys don't. You know, the little girls are there in the mama's lap and so on and so forth, and they're held and they're hugged, and the boys don't get that. So there's got to be a complete difference in the way that you view the world. And what you're doing, obviously, is the right way to do it, because they look like happy kids. You can see them on the picture, their picture on the cover of the book. But what you're doing, you've got probably a 10 times tougher job because you didn't get the lap time. Yeah. So,
well, that's
how do you
for sure.
How do you give somebody something that you've never been exposed to?
Now, that does create challenges, but sure. I think in that challenge, it gives you the opportunity to decide how you're going to create a reality for your girls. And for me, you know, I was raised here in Texas with a very acute style, and it was a lot. It was very male driven, the style, and here I am in a position now to try to connect to these girls, and I have to create this canvas on my own. And you know, I was listening to them one evening at the dinner table, and they were talking about their friends and talking about their world and how all these things were sort of happening and swirling about. And I realized at that moment I wasn't connecting to what they were saying, because number one, I didn't know some of these names that they were throwing up. I didn't realize they'd gone on a field trip. I didn't know that they were experiencing that in school. I didn't even know they were taking that class in elementary. And I thought, oh my gosh, I should know these things. And the more I listened, the more convicted I got about my lackadaisical approach to really seeing them and being proactive. And I was tired. I didn't want my wife to be the sole interpreter of their world to me and then for her to have to run interference and be some sort of a referee. I didn't want that position. I wanted to be, my heart was to be with them and to be in the theater of their mind. I wanted a front row seat to this. And so with that came the concept of really doing these one-on-one individual meetings, dates, to go out with them. So I call them on the phone. I ask them to go out with me because it's sort of a dress rehearsal opportunity. And of course, they're 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 and 10 years old, and they were all lit up about it. They thought this was a great idea, and so I would come into the door and pick them up and sort of walk them to the door with a flower in their hand, and be sure that every door that presented itself to me, I was sure to open it before she did. I wanted her to realize that this is what dates feel like, and we would go to a restaurant that I knew she would love because it had the kind of food that particular kid really enjoyed, and then we would focus on conversation, and I wanted to learn about their friends, and I wanted to learn about how they thought about their friends, and what made this exciting versus that. And the more that I got involved that way, the more they were letting me in. They would talk to me about it, and as soon as I realized that I couldn't just react as a dad, if they said, you know, Daddy, this guy likes me or whatever, I couldn't respond and say, oh, that's a bad idea. I just wanted to listen as a friend, and there was plenty of times to talk as a dad later, but at this moment, this was my one shot to be the guy that she needed for me to be in that moment. And the more that I did that night after night with each girl, and the more opportunities arose for us to do these one-on-one connecting dates, the more I realized that this is my shot to really play this kind of a proactive role with them. And I got to tell you, I can't imagine not doing it anymore, you know.
Sure. Now, but what kind of a reaction did your wife have about all this? Because now all of a sudden, dad is taking on some of the role that traditionally mom's taken on.
Well, as you might imagine, it can be a very nemesising situation for a husband to sort of want to grab the steering wheel here a little bit in an area that mom normally drives in. Sure. But in the same breath, any wife would probably be super glad for a husband to take even more responsibility in connecting with your kids. So very few ladies are going to be frustrated with the notion that a guy would step in like that. But the one cautionary moment that I would say, because you brought up something very interesting, and mine was overjoyed with the notion that I would take the bull by the horns here. But I'll tell you this much. There is, our society has manufactured, and you've seen this, you've seen these super moms, and we have only viewed super moms as that, super moms. They do everything. But what I would like to suggest is, and I don't know all supermoms, and I certainly don't want to subtract away from the amazing role that mothers play in girls' lives, because they're so vital and necessary, and God love these women who hurl themselves into their families. I honor them and I respect them. But I got to tell you, there can be a downside to this supermom thing. Because a superhero mom has a tendency to create a very demeaning role for the dad. And I know that's never the motivation for the mom. But the more super the mom, the less super the dad, it seems. And the dad becomes this sort of guy who, he pays the bills, but he just doesn't have much of a role in that. And that's usually why the mom is super, because the dad's kind of asleep at the wheel. But the one thing I'll say is, you know, shared parenting control over these kids is probably the right, mathematical equivalence or equation for us to be pursuing. But I find that dads get sort of kicked out of their place sometimes accidentally because moms take up so much space in the parenting role. The dad's not sure where he's supposed to be, so he just settles for paying bills. And what my challenge to guys are, look, society has maybe painted us as bubbling idiots. There are so many sitcoms on TV that the dad looks like he's just the biggest jerk in the world, or he's just clueless, doesn't get anything, and he just tries, but it's a failed attempt, and we just sort of, you know, pat him on the back and tell him to go sit in the corner. And what I'm saying is, I believe that most dads are way more intuitive than what society or ourselves give us credit for. And your kids need you to be way more proactive with them. And one of the reasons why I think we've got a lot of trouble with kids and teenagers and young 20s and 30s with struggling character traits is because our dads just didn't play enough of a role in our worlds.
And I think it's time that we sort of reverse that and we step up. And I don't know how it works for every marriage, and every marriage is different. But I really want to encourage dads to play a lot more of a forward role in this. And that's why this book came out. I didn't want to write a book necessarily because I just thought I'd arrive at a conclusion with parenting. I wanted to write a book because I wanted to encourage dads to be even better than they currently are with their kids. And we've provided specific tips and tools on how they can do that. And maybe it'll encourage them and spark some new ideas in them that they maybe don't apply it the same way I do, but they apply it in their own way. And I couldn't be more jazzed about the notion that we could spark something in a guy. So if I've said anything important here in this last little minute, it would be the notion that I think dads have a lot more to provide to their kids than what maybe we've been labeled to provide.
One thing, well, we're starting to run out of time, Greg, but I think it's important that in your press release it's saying something to the effect of you won't let the kids date until they're of college age.
Yeah, let me talk about that. It's that may sound like a fear-based rule. It's actually not, because I'm super proactive in my girls' lives, and I'm not afraid of them connecting with guys. But let me tell you what my focus is. I believe that the key to a successful marriage starts with them being friends, best of friends. And in order to become a best friend, you have to allow time for the friendship to nurture and blossom and grow before romance gets involved into the equation. And one thing we do, we like boys, we invite boys over, we're attracted to boys, that's fine. We just don't do the ownership of a boyfriend and girlfriend connection. So it's not, that's my boyfriend, that's my girlfriend. What we do is we do friendship. So we do group stuff. We just don't do alone time with boys until each of these girls are ready. My oldest one recently became ready, and she's currently in a relationship with a guy. But she's 18. But in order to do that, the three of us sat down and we talked about the guidelines of the relationship and what a healthy relationship looked like. And I want to give my girls the absolute best opportunity to connect and to have a really amazing shot at a cool relationship. And there's no guarantees. And you never know what's going to end up happening, but you can sure do your best. And that's certainly what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, you see, you do it the way I did it years ago. She'd say, "I'm going out." I say, "Great, where are we going?" Greg, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Indeed. If you just simply go to daddydatesthebook.com, you'll be able to see some really good information there. Also, our book is found in any of the usual suspects of the bookstores, Barnes & Noble, Amazon.com, of course. We do have electronic books, and it's available on Kindle and all of that. You can also go to your local Christian bookstore. It's there as well. But if you have any other need for other information, just I'll steer you back to daddydatesthebook.com, and you should find us there. And we'd be happy to give any additional insight or additional intel on some thoughts we have on how to continue to nurture your relationship with your kids on that website as well. So we're on Twitter and on Facebook, and we'd love to be a resource for people who need one.
Wonderful. Hey, Greg, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Take care. Good night.
Thanks.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there, when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one
single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Boston.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Angela Hart with us. She's the author of Through Angela's Eyes, The Inside Story of Operation Firewall. And it started out as a personal battle against those terrorizing her by, listen to it, stealing her identity through her personal computer. It turned into one of the largest cases of identity theft in United States history. And let us say, Angela, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, and thank you so much for being here. There's so many people who are being hit with identity theft. Let's go all the way back and start from scratch. Where was it? What happened to you? When did you realize that somebody got a hold of the card?
Well, the first thing that happened was I had opened a bank account for an e-commerce website that I was starting, which is an internet store that I was going to be doing online. And initially, everything was going okay. And then a few months later, I stopped getting my bank statements. So I called the bank up and I said, well, what's going on? I'm not getting the bank statement. So they verified my address and they said, no, the address is correct and you should be getting them. Well, that went on for several months, and finally I went to the post office one day and there were six of my bank statements all rubber banded together and all opened. And when I looked at them, I could see that somehow my name was the same, but my address had changed. They had me at an address that I've never even lived at, never even lived in that town. And so I called up the bank, and I said, I'd like to verify the address on my account. Once again, they assured me, nothing wrong. So I said, well, I'm coming in.
Yeah.
So I went down with the bank statements and showed them. And I said, I'd like to know, you know, who gave you authority to change my address. And they were just flabbergasted at what I was showing them because they had no idea how it happened.
No. By the way, what was their, I'm going to use the word excuse. What was their response to this? And after they realized that whatever happened, happened, and all of a sudden you've got a different address on there and somebody is doing something with your account.
Well, they didn't really have a response for me because they weren't sure how it happened. They guaranteed me that they didn't do it from their end. So that only left me with one option, that somehow somebody got into my bank account. So at that point, I started getting a little nervous about things. And then what happened was, about a month later, I get a phone call from the electric company saying that I was late on a payment. And I said, well, I mailed the payment out. I said, but I don't know why the check hasn't cleared. I said, let me check with the bank because maybe somehow you posted it to somebody else's account. And the guy was very insistent that I make payment arrangements that minute. And I said, listen, I said, I sent you a check, this check number for this amount. It should have cleared. So he said, well, if you don't make plans now, we're going to be turning your electric off tomorrow. So I said, well, what if I just make a very small payment? $10, $20?
Yeah.
Will that suffice for now so you don't turn my electric off and I can find out what happened to the check? So he said, yeah, no problem. So before I even gave him my account information, I just said I'd like to pay X amount of dollars from my checking account. And he said to me, he says, are you sure you have enough funds in your checking account to cover this? And at that point, I realized something was wrong because bill collectors just want to take your information and run. So I got his name, I got his employee number, I got his phone number, hung up, called my bank, found out that my bank account had been closed out for a week and there were no funds in the bank. Not only had they closed my bank account out, they went into my line of credit and closed the account.
No, wait, who's
the
bank?
The bank.
Who is they? When you said they closed out the account and they closed out the line of credit.
Whoever had gotten into my bank account,
okay.
Because I didn't know at that point.
Okay.
So what happened was, you know, I had to go down to the bank, open a new account, file a police report. I had to get all the information from the bank, file the police report and all that. So now I'm working on my e-commerce website, trying to get that going. And all of a sudden, I started getting messaged from somebody I didn't know. And they told me that they knew who I was and where I lived and that they were stalking me. So at first I thought, all right, maybe this is a prank. Maybe somebody's just playing around with something. And so I closed the account out and I reopened a new account. And then they continued their conversation but under a different username. And I'm asking them, well, how are you doing this? Because you're either in my Yahoo or you're in my computer.
Yeah.
Because you're following me with everything I do. So what I did was I closed out of that account and I logged in under my friend's name. And the guy started messaging back and says, I thought you were going to bed. I was like, that was Natalie. This is Lisa. I said, how the hell are you doing this? I said, now you're really pissing me off. And he says, well, we know who you are and where you live. And I said, yeah, right. And he proceeded to write my name and address. So at that point, I knew it was real.
That
and that
scary?
Was after he had threatened my life as well.
Was that
so
a little
at that
scary?
Point, excuse me?
I said, was that a little scary?
You could say that.
You know, if somebody threatens you face to face, that's one thing.
I have a hard time hearing you. So.
Oh, okay. Let me turn up the volume a little bit. If somebody threatens you face to face, can you hear me okay now?
Yeah.
Okay. If somebody threatens you face to face, that's one thing, you see who it is. But when somebody's doing it and you don't know how they got there or who they
right.
are, that's got to be a little, that's got to shake you up a bit.
It does. And especially when you go to the police and you tell them what happened, and I gave them a copy of the chats. I had saved all the chats. Because I just thought it was odd that these people are messaging me, and I didn't know who they were, but they knew who I was. And when I handed it to the police, they said, well, we can't get to your case for 3 months. And I was like, why? I said, these guys have threatened my life. And they said, well, homicides take precedence. I was like, excuse me. I said, but I really don't think the dead guy is going to mind if you wait to for his case for 3 months. These people have threatened my life. So they said, well, that's the way it is. So I said, well, if that's the case, I said, I'm going to document as much as I can. I'm going to get as much information as I can. Right now, I couldn't tie up, you know, the computer for that long because I was opening this e-commerce website, and I already had payments coming in on my loans. So we agreed to do that, and in the meantime, the police did monitor the computer as well. So what I did was I knew that the one guy that kept messaging me had a webcam, but I couldn't get him to turn it on for me. And I got a phone call from a friend of mine in Oregon one day, and they told me, oh, some guy is messaging us. We don't know who he is. And I said, please, don't talk to him. I think he's one of the guys that hacked my computer. He might have been the guys that closed my bank accounts. And they're like, oh, no, we'll do everything we can to help you. So I said, well, the police are involved in all this. I said, but I know he has a webcam, and I can't get him to turn it on. And she says, well, he turns it on for us all the time. So I was like, oh, okay. Mm. So what I did was I had to do all the investigation, like, ahead of time. How, if I get him to turn on his webcam, how am I going to snag his picture? So I had to download a program so that I could do a screenshot of my desktop to get his picture. So what I did one night was I accessed the Internet through the web chat under their username, and I got him to turn the webcam on. And as soon as he did, I snagged his picture and I printed it. So then I got thinking, well, how do I know that the person I'm viewing is actually the person that's typing the text? So the guy would continue to talk to me day after day. So finally I asked him, I said, listen, if you're going to continue to talk to me online, I'd like your phone number and I'd like to talk to you over the phone. So he gives me a phone number. So I called from a calling card so it wouldn't show my home number, just in case he wasn't the hacker. And I talked to him for about 5 minutes. Then I hung up. Then I got thinking about it, going, well, how do I know that the person I saw on the computer is the same person on the other end of the phone, because I don't know that for sure. So what I did was I got him to turn his webcam on the following day, and while he was online, I called him and watched him answer the phone. And that's when the police realized they had the identity of the first hacker, because I had his picture, I had a phone number, I had a name, and an address to go with it.
Wow. I mean, that's phenomenal.
But I had to become my own advocate.
Yeah, I bet these people are sorry. There is one thing that is in your press release that I think is extremely important to say right now. Your story led to over 4,000 cases, well over 64,000 arrests as of December 2005. And with the investigations as a result, over $260 billion per year is being saved by taking these criminals off the street. Amazing how many people are involved in this stuff.
The original case of Operation Firewall only netted 48 people, 28 in the U.S. and 20 overseas. But as a result of watching and getting the identity of the first hacker, it led to these other people that were either hacking or selling stolen information, people that belonged to websites that were actually selling credit card information and they were purchasing it illegally. And a lot of them have hit the news. One of them was T-Mobile. They hacked T-Mobile and Paris Hilton's address book was stolen. That was the same guy that had hacked my computer. He also had hacked Bank of America. They hacked MasterCard Visa. They hacked Citibank. They had hacked the senators' identities, which at that point, that was a little bittersweet because it couldn't have happened to a better group of people, because once it happened to them personally, they started cutting through the red tape and passing the laws they needed to.
Now, by the way, let me ask you a question at this point, Angela. I think it's extremely important. Is why were they calling you? After they had taken your money, why were they persisting on calling you?
I think they were just trying to scare me off because they saw that I was persistent and that I was trying to track them down and...
No, I got it loud and clear, and I think what you did was absolutely brilliant. It's too bad that it had to happen to you to bring the relief to so many other people. Did you ever get your money back, or did you lose?
Not a dime, and I was stuck paying off all my debt for the e-commerce website, which I don't understand why, because at that point in time, it was in the middle of the case. They actually watched my websites get hacked. And yet they stuck me paying off two credit cards and a small business loan on the website. I never got a dime back from any of my bank accounts being closed or for anything that they did to me. Not to mention all the time that I lost during the investigation, all the heartache they put me through.
Yeah, and by the way, and it didn't help you financially, but you got your payback.
Yeah, they're all arrested. They're all in jail.
Which is a good thing, which says don't mess with you. And I think that's a great takeaway from this, because if they think they're professional, they don't know who they're dealing with. You know, if they stay under wraps, quote unquote, they don't know who they're dealing with, and took somebody like yourself to say, okay, you want it, here it comes. And look what happened to them.
Yeah. Yep.
No, I think it's great. Now, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at and buy the book?
Yes. It's through AngelasEye.com, singular eye. Otherwise, you get somebody else's website. And the book is available there as well as at Barnes & Noble and Amazon and in a lot of bookstores.
Yeah. Angela, hey, thank you so much. Too bad you had to go through that. But at the same time, look how much you saved other people. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. And there's just a lot of information in the book on how they did it and why they did it and ways to protect yourself as well. So it's a good resource for people.
By the way, I just talked to somebody, when was it, within a week or so ago, who gave me a credit card to pay for something, and the card was denied, and I called her back about it, and she checked with the bank. It was on a Friday. She checked with the bank on Monday. Somebody tried to hit her for $8,000 on her account. So you never know when it's going to happen.
No. And it happens all too often. But at least there's laws on the books now that you're only responsible for the first $50 of a fraudulent transaction.
Oh, how good. Now that's great. Now that is that's phenomenal.
One of the best laws.
Yeah, you got it. Okay, hey, by the way, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Okay, thank you.
Take care. Good night.
Some of these days, you'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you won't get, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these. Said some of these days I do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm lost. For you, leave me. You know it's gonna grieve me. You're missing your brown-eyed daddy. Grab it now, some of these days.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Sunil Gupta with us, MD. He is the founder of the Retinal Specialty Institute, and we're going to be talking about helping veterans get jobs. Those who come back, they're just out of work, and it's a problem, and it's a problem that we really shouldn't have. So, Sunil, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. What caused you to begin with to take this project on? Obviously, it's not something that was out there. You saw something, and you're starting to do something about it. What was it that stimulated you to action?
Sure. So we're actually in the panhandle of Florida, we have a number of armed forces and Air Force Base, Navy Base around us. So we typically have a lot of active duty personnel in the area, and we've been used to hiring their spouses typically, and knowing that they're going to even be here just for a few years, we've been very fortunate in that we've been able to help them and they've been able to help us, and so we were tuned in to this whole idea of working with our military and helping their spouses. However, my son happened to just write a paper for a contest that the Navy was sponsoring here locally in Pensacola, and the paper was on how to rehabilitate returning veterans. And, you know, again, all of us continue to do what we do in day-to-day work, working, you know, 60, 80 hours a week, and don't really pay attention to those kind of things until I read his essay, which actually stimulated me to think about, hey, you know, what can we do? And just around that time, we had one of my employees asked me that one of the family friends had returned from Iraq, and he was on the front line and came back, couldn't find a job. He was working at the movie theater, basically sweeping floors and serving up popcorn, and she thought that he had much more of an ability to work as a team member in our group. And so that sort of stirred me to give him an opportunity. So this was a young man that enlisted, Owen enlisted in the Army at age 17 and basically went off and came back at age 22, 23 and didn't have any skill sets, at least that he thought that would acclimate him back into society. So we decided to go ahead and bring him into the practice, and for about 6 weeks, she worked with him hand one-on-one to train him to do ophthalmology technician work. We provided him materials for education, et cetera, and lo and behold, he got, 6 months down the road and became very adept at all the testing and all the examination techniques that we do. It turns out that Dr. Franklin, who's one of my partners, actually feels that this kid is now, you know, one of his number one people that helps him on day-to-day practice. So that is kind of how we came about this.
Now, by the Clinton Global Initiative, now, that obviously focused on job creation, American unemployment, et cetera, and you were there. Did they address this particular problem with those coming back from Afghanistan, from Iraq, from places like that? Did they address the problem, or were they just talking about, in general, American unemployment?
Great. So, yeah, I actually got invited to your birth city, actually. It was in Chicago. And the goal was to have different thought leaders from different communities, and I thought I was being invited there to participate in the healthcare workforce group. But they actually assigned me to the Veterans Workforce Group, and so that was sort of a fluke thing. And it turned out that they actually had a group of about 40 or 50 very, very committed veterans and other community leaders as well as business leaders that would break up into these small workshops and actually try to identify ways that we could incorporate these men and women as they're returning back to the state. So, yeah, the whole reason that I actually got stirred up to challenge others to sort of look at what they can do about this situation was because Clinton Global Initiative actually stimulated me to do that.
Now, by the way, they got the right guy at the right time because you got into it and you saw what I guess a lot of people weren't seeing. These kids coming back, and most of them are kids, and you're right, their skill sets, they weren't trained to do anything, or what they were trained to do is not going to apply when they come back as civilians. What do we do with most of the kids? You know, obviously, that you can hire certain people, and in the field of ophthalmology, there's things that you can teach them. But there's a lot of kids that are coming back that won't get into that field, and there's more than your particular field can handle. What do you do about those? Who do you contact? Who do you create training programs with?
Sure. So the original training program for ophthalmic techs was started by the Air Force, actually, for reasons in that they needed assistance in the operating room and in their clinics. And then that program went public about 30 years ago or longer. So I think, you know, one of the reasons, obviously, that I'm on this campaign or initiative is to try to get people to think about these kind of things and to say, okay, so ophthalmology potentially can train some of these returning men and women and incorporate them in their practices. So why can't the orthopedic surgeons do that, or the dermatologists or the radiologists? So, you know, we've got 20 or 30,000 that will be coming back in the next 12 months, I believe. So I just want to put the challenge out there that, you know, you have to be thinking out of the box. I mean, there's 1% of the population that volunteers to go overseas and do this for us so that the rest of us can go on with our day-to-day lives without, unfortunately, thinking much about that. Well, it's time that, you know, when these kids coming back, that we think about how we're going to pay them back. And I think that, yes, it's not going to be easy. And certainly Owen did not have any medical experience. He hadn't been in the clinic. He didn't know how to work with patients. However, he had training in regards to being a team player. He was very efficient. He was very aware of his surroundings and wanted to work to excel, just like all of these kids or most of these kids will want to do. So those are the qualities that you can take and utilize them to plug these kids into a number of medical practices, certainly the hospital, the surgical center. But also, I mean, I would challenge other small businesses, which a lot of physician practices are, other businesses outside of healthcare to say, hey, you know, how can I incorporate these kids into my business? And always, you know, the small businesses are the growth engines, and that's where we're going to come out of this recession. But I would challenge people to think about these kids as potentially some that could help them grow their business. And I think there's probably a role for government somewhere in that if they could support us. For example, Georgia does a program where they pay for, I believe, a six-week internship for not necessarily veterans, but just people that may be interested in doing an apprenticeship-type internship. And then at the end of the 6 weeks, you know, if the particular job fits the client and if the employer wants them, then they keep them on and they become part of the employee force. And if it doesn't work, you know, this person has learned a new skill set that may be combined with other things, and maybe they can go on to some other type of work in the future.
You know, when we take kids that put their life on the line for the country and for you and I and everybody here, there should be no reason they should come back without jobs. There should be no reason they come back without a place to live and go hungry. And, you know, the stories, we can go on and on about this. There is an absolute role. By the way, I believe in small government. I just totally believe in that. But at the same time, I do believe that there is a role for government, and you just mentioned it, to be able to educate these kids coming back in. They should have in-house, quote-unquote, colleges or technical schools that can prepare them to go back out into the job market. You take a kid 20 years old, 18 years old, who's put their life on the line that might not have come back, or you take some of these kids who have been harmed, they've lost a leg, they've lost something, their sight. And how do you repay them? You don't just say, well, we can't afford it, and you're going to have to stand in line for 6 months and maybe you'll get it. It takes the incentive away, number one. And number two, those are the very same kids that allow you and I to be talking tonight.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And, you know, I'm an immigrant. I was 11 when I came to the States, and it was interesting. We came around the early 70s, and in looking back, interestingly, we didn't do a great job with the returning Vietnam vets, I don't think. And I think that this is a chance for us to do it right. And so we can't be just saying, oh, we want the troops back. You know, the troops are coming back. We're getting them back. So now we've got to figure out how we're going to take care of them because they took care of us.
Well, absolutely. No question about that. And when we talk about immigrants, my father was an immigrant. My father came in, I think it was right around the turn of the century. And he became an American. And one of the responsibilities that I believe in my heart, once you become a citizen of the country belongs to you. And the responsibility that you have for the country is to make sure that those people who go out and protect your rights to live and be free and to raise a family and make an income, they're taken care of when they go out and they do their job and they come back, or if they come back.
I completely agree. And it's not that everybody needs to go out and hire one of these kids coming back. I mean,
no.
You can take the opportunity to train them, to teach them a skill set, and they may not end up working for you. You may not be looking for somebody to hire at the moment. But if you give them that skill set, then the next person may be interested in picking them up. So, you know, there's many different ways to give back, and I just want people to start thinking about it. And obviously the Clinton Global Initiative got me stirred up to, you know, do something.
Sure. Now, by the way, where you are, how is the unemployment rate? Is it strong? Is it medium? What's it like there?
So our unemployment rate in Florida is pretty high. I think we're at 11%. And the Pensacola region, northwest Florida, is around 9 or 10%. We're higher than the national average, but lower than Florida. But if you look at these kids, you know, I think that the recently deployed vets, the unemployment rates are running around 11 or 12%. And then if you break that down even further, looking at males that are returning that are under 25, their unemployment rate reaches, I think, around 27%. So,
sure.
I mean, it really behooves us to, you know, do something to help these kids because, obviously, I love what I do. I love working. Obviously, you do as well. And I think the work...
Sure.
actually stimulates us to do more. And I think that if we don't engage these kids that are used to, you know, 24 hours of focus, I think, bad things happen. So, I mean, I think as a country, not only is it good to employ them, but I think it's important to keep the psyche of these kids that are returning to make sure they're employed and they're productive.
Oh, sure. And what are we talking about, 100,000 coming back in the next couple of months?
Exactly. I think that there's 30-some thousand coming in the next few months, I believe. But over the next few years, you're right. I mean, I think it's over 100,000 that will be returning. And, yeah, you know, even if you take some of these kids on as apprenticeships in terms of teaching them entrepreneurship, teaching them, you know, skill sets that you have that you may be able to pass on to them, I think it would be you know, something that would give great returns to you.
Oh, and by the way, and it all comes under the auspices of payback. Now, is there a website that you have if anybody wants to help, to contribute, to support, get involved with? What website can we find you at?
So, I mean, the first website I would recommend would be the Clinton Global Initiative, and they have a subsection in there on veterans. And so go look on that. Our work group had come up with some initiatives as well as some recommendations that people could participate in on that site. Our personal website for our practice is retinaspecialty.com, and we're going to be actually creating a page specifically sort of committed to this in terms of our commitment, and we are in the process of honing our initiative with the Clinton Group to try to see how we can, you know, challenge the Academy of Ophthalmology or the Academy of Sports Medicine or Orthopedic Surgery to really step up and take this as an initiative for the larger organization.
By the way, and I want to thank you, and I want to thank you for what you're doing and the support for the troops and all of the areas that, knock on wood, hopefully, that you're going to be able to touch. And we're just about finished up with it, and I want to thank you so much for being here. Sunil, I think what you're doing is just absolutely phenomenal, and there's some lives you'll save out there with this.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Hey, good night.
Good night.
Off comes the makeup, off comes the clown's disguise, the curtains falling, the music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends,
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.